So I have entitled this abstract interpretation for the theoretician, but in fact it's very basic theory, and it's very old. So why should we? So I follow the first advice of Danvi. Explain why you do this. That's the only advice that I have followed. All are counter examples. So, so you can show the counter example on the fly. That would be great fun, I think. So why should we formalize design by abstract interpretation? So the origin of abstract interpretation is essentially Peter Noor, who invented the analysis using abstract values in a compiler in 1966. Then he had a student who was called Sinzoff, and this student, who is now old, was understood that it can be more general than the 17 value that he had chosen, and he gave a few examples, and this text is taken from his paper. So he says, when I do a square plus b square, it leads the object pose when a and b are the object pose or next. And when the valuation is defined as follows, so it's more or less a rule of sign. Positive plus positive is positive. Positive multiplied by negative is negative. And then what he defined as a valuation, he says valuation of p plus q is valuation of p plus valuation of q. And valuation of 0 is valuation of 1 and is pose. And valuation of minus 1, minus 2 is negative. Then he says the valuation of a times a square plus b square is posed by the following computation. And in fact, there are two computations. One is in the case pose, so you get a square is posed by pose, which is pose. And B is what? B is pose here, and 2 positive is positive, and you get it. So, and then you do the sum, and the other case is neg, and it's also positive. And there is something wrong about that. So I go back. There is something that doesn't work here. I follow the second example advice by Danvi. It's have your audience participate and solve your problems. Yes? Yes.
Moving from A to A
So I have not understood the problem. So moving from
A, which has been evaluated to positive negative.
Yes.
Evaluation of A times A.
Yes.
If you could abstract from the
but the rule of sign is okay. It is when you multiply 2 positive number, it's positive, and 2 negative number, it's positive either. You are found. You don't want
zero.
Me to move because your film becomes. No? I have to move slowly.
No, it's fine.
You have an answer to the question?
Yeah, zero.
Great. So you should turn your camera to yourself.
Zero. Zero times a negative number is
exactly.
Not positive.
Exactly.
I mean, it is positive.
Is the valuation of zero is positive. So if I multiply 0 by minus 1, so I have a slide for that. You see, because of V of 0 is positive, V of minus strictly negative is neg. When I do this evaluation, I find neg, and I have proved that 0 is less than 0. So that's so you see there is, and most, when you read most papers, they are all wrong. So because they do errors like this, there is some misunderstanding either in the semantics or in the abstraction. And most papers I read, including mine, have bugs. So we want to avoid mistakes, but it's...
Mathematician?
What?
Who was the Indian mathematician?
The Indian mathematician is the one who got it right. So it's, you see, a few centuries before now. And he even had a zero rule. So he had a zero in his rule. And the only rule which was wrong is zero divided by zero is zero, which is not true in mathematics, but you have several programming languages where this is a choice. So, and so this guy is the inventor of abstract interpretation in a sense. So there is another thing that is wrong, and I have cheated in the first course. You were not aware of that, but I was cheating consciously. And the cheat is the following, because we were discussing properties and it was not very clear which how I define properties, and I have been doing something implicit that you did not notice. So a property of element of a set is usually defined by some formula. People understand logic, so they say even of x is some abbreviation for x is a natural number, and there is a natural number so that x is 2 times k. And this logic formula has an interpretation, which is a set of all x that satisfy the formula, and it is exactly the set of all even numbers. And so there is no difference between the formula and the set that it represents. And so in abstract interpretation, we reason on the set. We take a point of view that a property is a set of all elements that have this property. And this is because we don't want to stick to a language, and because we have problems, have languages have problems, and I will come back to this. And to avoid this, we use a kind of universal language where everything exists, and you have no problem of expression, no problem of existence. So by going to set theory, we can express all the mathematics, whereas if you take any logic, you get problems. So now if you take the semantics as traces, the trace is one execution, the set of all traces is the semantics, all the possible execution. And so properties are set of traces, because a property of a semantic of a program is a set of all semantics of that program that have this property. So here is an example. This property is when I execute my program, it always finishes with x is 0, or it always finishes by x is 1. So I have this. I can make this experience. I run the program and it returns 0. And now I say whenever I will rerun it, I will always get 0. Now there is another one here, which is sometime it returns 0 and sometime it returns 1. And I have many of these. You see there are many of these here maybe. And now if I make an experience and I get 0, I cannot say predict the next one. So these two properties are completely different. And now I make the abstraction that I left implicit in my first talk. I make the union of these two sets. So see here, this possible execution, I make their union, and here I make their union. And so my abstraction is, I take, this is one execution that is a semantic, that is a property. And given a property, I make the union of all the sets that are in the property. And now I get something which is more abstract because I have lost information, and I get that. Now from that, I cannot distinguish the two programs which were one when I know when I execute once what will be all result and the second one. So now they are the same because when I describe at this level of abstraction, I cannot make any difference between these two programs. And this is what computer scientists call properties. And this is, they say, it's either safety or liveness. And they think that all program properties are safety or liveness, whereas this is neither a safety nor liveness property. It's something more concrete, and it's only when I abstract it that I can say the abstraction is a safety property or a liveness property. So in my first talk, I started from that, because it's simpler. If I had started explaining this at the second slide, you would not have followed. So I followed one advice of Danville, makes it so simple. So now we have two cases. I don't read that. I will come back on this. Yes?
Good question. So the abstraction there is traces terminate in 0 or 1. That's the abstraction.
No, the abstraction is...
Take the property, which is a set of somethings, and you make their union. There is no 0, 1 in my abstraction. It's the example where I have... In the example, I have 0, 1, but in general, I have anything. So I have not understood your question on the example.
When you go to that slide,
yes.
No, the next one there, for this example, the property that you're describing there is the trace terminates in 0 or 1.
Yes, but not exactly.
How would you phrase this one? Yes, so, and they are not the same property. You see, they are not the same objects. And so there is something that is there that is misunderstood. Because this one, you would not phrase it, it's always 0 or 1. So there is more. You have to say, if I make an experience, I get 0, then all others will get 0. And if I make an experience at 1, all other will be 1. So you have to explain that this is a set of set to find some sentence. And if you say 0 or 1, you have flattened everything. So implicitly, your or just make this abstraction in your implicitly. And I think that's a difficulty that is not well understood. And for example, when you go to security, there are properties that are neither safety nor liveness. And you have to express it this way. A simple example also is... the execution of a function does not depend on some parameter. It's not a safety or liveness property. So, yeah, there is another.
For examples of why we would care to distinguish between those two classes of properties. Why to distinguish between those two classes of properties?
Because it's not the same problem. If I ask you write a
problem like that satisfies this specification, you can say print 0. Or you can say print 1. But you cannot say, take a random, make an input, and if the input is 10, then print 0, and if it's 11, take print 1.
So I can't imagine someone to write that program, though. So I was after examples.
You can, because...
So here you can express security property, and I'm sure you want to have your program to be secure. And not all security properties are safety of liveness. And so not all properties are safety of liveness. That's the point. So maybe you can say, I'm only interested in safety and liveness and not in security. So I say that's your problem. There are security properties that you can translate into safety and liveness. But for example, equivalence of programs is not a safety or liveness. But I can express equivalence of program in this way. So maybe you say I'm not interested in equivalence. So that's okay. So in this talk, I will always start with abstraction to make things simple. So now the next point is that we have a fixed point at the origin, and when we make abstraction, we keep fixed points. So we will have fixed points everywhere. In computer science, fixed points are everywhere because everything is an abstraction of something which is a fixed point right at the beginning. So we remember that we had the execution model by a set of traces. So for this program, the initial state is random. Then I pick a random number, and in this execution, I get 2. Then I move to 3 with 2. I decrement. And when I come back, it's no longer strictly greater than 1, so I finish at 4. So this kind of traces can be defined formally. And you have this definition which says if I describe a step of a program execution step by a transition system, then the traces, and I take only the prefix of the traces, so it's also an abstraction. I start with something which is not the most concrete possible. This set is a set of all finite traces so that at any point there is a transition from one state to the other, to the next one, which satisfies this transition relation that I have not defined. It's somewhat obvious. So from this definition, I can extract a fixed point. And the fixed point is this one. A trace is either reduced to one state, because it's I make an observation of the beginning state and then I or I have made some observation, a finite one, and I do one more step. So I have a trace which is in the set, and it has a final state, and from that final state I can make one more step to sigma prime, and so there exists also a longer trace which is the previous one plus one step. So the idea is any trace is either of length 1 or of length 2 because it's a length 1 plus 1 transition, or length 3 because it's a length 2 with plus 1 transition, and so on. Now if I take, we have seen an example last time where the fixed point equation was not unique, has not a unique solution, so here I have the same problem. And so first I observe that I can write this in fixed point form by defining this function with x which is p, so when I write f of pt here, I get exactly this formula. And now I have this other property that I can prove. The proof is a bit long, so I don't do it. If you have another fixed point, then it includes all the traces that are defined by pt, this definition. So if you take this definition as pt and you take any other fixed point, then it's larger. So this means that the set of partial traces generated by a transition system is the least fixed point for this order inclusion of this function. And because of that, everything will be fixed points in our life, because what we do now is just start from this semantics and make abstraction. If I were to go to the case of set of traces, then it would be more complicated. So here is an example of abstraction. That's a summary of a paper. Here you have semantics which is just complete finite or infinite traces, and there are essentially two abstractions. One is the angelic abstraction, which is partial correctness. I just forget the infinite traces, and this one is called the demoniac abstraction, where if I have an initial state where non-termination is possible, I introduce all finite behaviors starting from this initial state. And when I have done this abstraction, if the initial state has the possibility of non-terminating, I can prove nothing. And so that's called total correctness. If you can prove nothing when you it does not terminate, it means that if you prove something, it must terminate. So you have to prove termination. And then when I have this, I can move to several other semantics. So the big move is this one. When I have a trace, I just remember the first and last state. So it's It's become a relation. I say when I start in this initial state, either I get non-termination, so I have a special bottom saying it's not termination, or I have a final state, which is this one, or one of these. And then all these are isomorphism, in fact, but with generalization. So if you replace a relation by a function, you take the right image of the function, you get the notational semantics. If you replace this by a predicate transformer, instead of having one state to final states, to set of final states, you take several initial states to several final states, that's predicate transformer. And there is also a bijection between predicate transformer to for logic, which is a bit more difficult. So it's generalization because the true semantics, they are abstraction of these. In particular, for example, Scott did not consider non-determinism in his initial. So you, if you want to get it, you have to say something like the system is deterministic, and then I get Scott semantics. So it's completely formal, that is, once I have defined this fixed point, and I have defined this function, everything is finished. There is only one solution. So I have to define what is a fixed point. Normally you know it. So the least fixed point of F for this order less than this is defined only if I have some poset where this is the order. And this must be an element of the poset, you see. And this is the least fixed point of F for this order, which is greater than A. So it's a fixed point, it's greater than A, and if there is another fixed point of F which is greater than A, the least fixed point is smaller. So when the order is obvious, I don't write it. When this is the smallest element, I don't write it. And the greatest fixed point is just the dual. So here is an example. You have a function like this, and this function has only one fixed point, at least on the part where we see, because there might be others here. And you see that in this area you have f of x which is greater than x, and if you take the intersection of all x so that f of x is less than x, you get exactly this fixed point. So that's Starsky's theorem. When it says if I have a complete lattice and an increasing function, or monotonic, or isotone function, then the set of fixed points is a complete lattice. And the least fixed point is the least element in the complete lattice. The greatest fixed point is obviously the greatest element in the complete lattice. And when you want to make the least fixed point which is greater than a set of fixed points, you make the union of the fixed points. And this is not a fixed point, so you recompute the least fixed point which is greater than this union of fixed points, and you get the lub in the lattice of fixed points. So that's technical but very useful. So this theorem is attributed to Knaster Tarski, and in fact the first version was only for sets and power sets, and they published together, but only Knaster put the name on the paper, and he said this is co-work with Tarski. So at the time, they had not statistics like we do now. And so it was not so important to have three or third or one. The importance was the result. And then Tarski generalized it. And now it's Tarski theorem. So what is interesting also is that you get a proof method. That is, because our semantics will be a fixed point, so we will be, because our semantics will always be in that form, we have a systematic method to prove that something is greater than the semantics. And to do that, we just say, to prove this, you have to guess some x which is larger than A, and so that of f of x is less than x. If you have done that, this x belongs to the set of here prefix point of f greater than A, and so it's larger than the intersection, which is the least fixed point. So there is an advice by Danville, which is don't use notation that you have not defined, and I have forgotten to define this one. So when I write f like this with a little dot before, it means x that f of x, or x is less than f of x. And when I write it after, I don't remember my convention, when I write it after, it's x that f of x is less than x. So it's a post-fixed point. So here the least fixed point is the intersection of all post-fixed points. And so here I have a post-fixed point, so the least fixed point is greater. So with this I can do a Floyd method, Floyd proof method. I can do OR logic, I can do everything. And I can do static analysis, because essentially I compute that automatically, or some approximation, we will see, and then I prove this implication by checking that. So in my first talk I had first part which is compute that, and then the second part which is prove this by checking that. And the whole problem is to find this x. So one solution is always to take this fixed point, but it's not computable, so that you have all the elements. So there is a particular case, which is the case of a continuous function. So continuous function, they are the case when it's a particular case of a monotonic function, so that if you take any chain which has a lub, then the image of the lub of the chain is the lub of the image of the chain. So let's take an example of function which is continuous and one which is not continuous. So I take the integers and I add one element above greater than all integers and another one which is greater than all than this element and all other elements. So I take a function which is not continuous, I add one. So for 0 I put 1, 1 I put 2, like this. And for this one I do that. And because it must be monotonic, for the last one I do that. And this one is not continuous, because if I take the union of these, I get this point. And if I make the f, I arrive here. Now if I do the other way is what? So I have done the first. So the other way is you just take the image of this point, of this point, this point, this point. So I get that. These are the image. And when I have taken the image, I make the lub. So I arrive there. So this function is not continuous. But if you want one which is continuous, you just take the same here and you do this. This one is continuous because if I take the images, the lub is that, so I arrive there. And if you take the lub, you take this, and you take the image, you arrive at the same point. And also you notice that if you are continuous, then the least fixed point must be at the limit. So that's the interest of this definition. So I have notation, I skip that. So the other interesting theorem, which is attributed to Clini, but that's wrong, because it is 48 and this is 28. So Kuratowski proved it even in the case of non-continuous function. And Tarski, in his famous paper, also gave this example, not in the case of continuous, but in the case of distributive, which is not so different. So it says if you have continuity then you can compute the least fixed point by iterating from the initial value. So it's here, let's say. So you start from the initial value, you apply F. So I start from the initial value, I apply F everywhere, so I get all these points. Then I take the lub, and I've got the fixed point. So here is another example. You see, I just compute the fixed point by iterating, and because it's continuous, this function, I arrive at the least fixed point. So when it is not, the Kuratowski says, when it is not continuous, you just go on iterating. So if this, the green one is not continuous, so I iterate, I go on, and at some point I will reach a fixed point. So now we have this. If you remember when we were making proof, we have to prove this. And how are we going to find the x here? How are we going to prove this? We need some general method, and the general method is given in this theorem. The trick is that I will approximate my function, which is complex, by a simpler function, which is an approximation from above. And when I do this approximation from above, I take something simpler. So I take the idea of approximate fixed point by fixed point, and I take the idea approximate by above by taking a function which is always above, point-wise. And so if I find such a function which is less than x, then I know by construction of g from f that also I have this property. And the trick will be that this one is very hard to compute, and this one hopefully is simpler. Obviously, it doesn't always work, because if I take x to be least fixed point of f, that is, you ask me to prove exactly the semantics, there is absolutely no abstraction that I can do, because the only thing that will work is to compute the semantics itself. And this is the classical incompleteness problem. So now we are left with the problem, how do we get g from f? And the idea is, because f is a map from some domain to another domain, we will abstract the domain. So we start from the domain of f, we abstract it, we get an abstraction of function on these domains, and then we need theorem that say how you abstract fixed points. So this is one. It says if f j is pointwise above f, then the least fixed point is definitely an approximation. So you have a first result here. So I will concentrate, this one is easy when you have got this one, so I must concentrate on how to abstract the domain itself. So in the first case, I consider you are lucky, there is a best abstraction. So I just don't read this one, I just announce, if you have a best abstraction, you have got a Galois connection, and there is a best way to do everything. It means that if I give you the least fixed point of f, I give you the alpha, the abstraction, then that's finished. All the things are perfectly specified. There is a way to define everything, but not the widening narrowing. Except for that, everything is perfectly defined. So the spec is only the semantics and the alpha. And if I give that to you, you know everything. So all paper in abstract interpretation should be, this is my function, my semantics, this is my abstraction, and the rest is automatic. So you could write in principle a formal system for writing papers when there is a best abstraction. Now the so let's take an example. So this example, we used it yesterday. The abstraction started from set of traces, and we were going to set of states. And the abstraction takes a set of traces, it looks at all the traces in the set, and for each of them, it will collect all the states that you find along the trace. So it was the invariance abstraction that we had. We just speak about state that you find during runtime. And so there is a best way of abstracting energy, just collect the states. And the concretization, you are given a set of states and you want to know what are the corresponding traces. So you say it's all traces which have only these traces, these states along their execution. But you have much more traces in here that you had at the beginning because you have shuffled all possible states in the sequence. So the very nice, this in this case you have very nice properties. The first, the concrete domain and the abstract domain are posets because set of state, power set is ordered by inclusion here. Then you have the abstraction is increasing, that is, if you have more traces, you have more states here. Now the gamma is increasing also because if you I give you more states, you will be able to build more traces. Then this is extensive, this means you do first alpha and you come back with gamma, you will recover more traces than you had at the origin. Now if you do the other way around, if you start from a set of states and you build the traces and you re-abstract to the states, yeah, you cannot find any new state. You find exactly the state that you had before. So this is this property that if I do gamma and then alpha, it is the identity. There are some cases where it is not the identity. You find less than in the abstract, and I will illustrate that, yes. And here is a counter example. So it's a SINZOF counter example. If you have only positive, negative, he had no top because in the rule of sign you don't give an answer. But in computer science, no answer must be something. So you have top to say, I don't know. And he has no bottom because there is no dead code in expressions, in his expression. So this is no value at all, it's dead code. So the gamma is here, you have all integers, negative integers, natural number, you see I took the sins of, no, I did it the other way around for negative or zero. It's strictly positive and empty. Now if you want to, and also zero here. So you see there are two choices for abstracting zero. And so when I have zero, I can say it's positive, or I can say it's negative. You see, SINZOF said it's always positive, but doing that is wrong. It's not wrong. That is, if you do it, then the rule of sign that you get is not the one, the classical one. So if I want to do this, sometimes I should say it's positive, and sometimes I should say it's negative. For example, if I do 0 plus 1, if I say 0 is positive, I have positive plus positive, I find positive. But if I say 0 plus 1, 0 is negative, I get negative plus positive and I don't know. So I should have chosen positive. And now if I do 0 minus 1, I should say it's negative because negative plus negative is negative. Whereas if I say positive, I don't know. So sometimes I should say positive, sometimes I should say negative. When there are cases like this in computer science, that's simple, you do backtracking. You try the first, it fails, you try the second. And backtracking has a nice property of being exponential, so you have no hope of succeeding. So when you have so it's a case when you have no best abstraction. So here. So Galois embedding is what I illustrated, where when you do gamma and then alpha, you get identity. So it is this one. And when you have the whole property that we have, if we take these four, that is, it's increasing, gamma is increasing, this one is extensive, and this one is reductive. you get what is called the Galois connection. It was invented by Galois in a particular case. It was for sets here, so the inclusion was sets here, and in this side it was superset. So it's not monotonic in the Aurel Dejean definition, it's antitonic. It changes the order. The problem is if you compose two things that change the order, you have something that keeps the order. So the composition of original Galois connection is not a Galois connection, whereas if you do this way, you inverse the original definition, then you get a composition. So I write it this way because you see I do alpha and then gamma, I am above. I do gamma and alpha, I am below. Wow. So that's an easy way to remember the formula. So you can rewrite these four conditions into one, which is this. And you can write it this way. If I have a concrete, I do the best abstraction and I over-approximate, then the concretization that is the meaning of this over-approximate is an over-approximation of the concrete. You can read this way in both directions. So in one formula, you get the definition and it's equivalent to these four conditions. So this was a counterexample. We don't have a Galois connection. We cannot have a Galois connection here. Well, you can also rewrite this condition in this style. So there is no quantification. It just really, you consider the order as a relation. So it's not very important. And the set of Galois connection is a complete lattice if you order them pointwise. And so you have seen that I draw lattice like the one with all semantics. For each point there is a Galois connection that define it. And so this is part of the lattice of all Galois connection when I take C to be the tracers. So when you give me a semantics, there is a big lattice which is all the Galois connections. And this is all possible abstractions. And we computer scientists, we live in this world. Because everything is the abstraction of a machine. Everything you say in computer science is some abstraction. So in the case of Galois embedding, we have that when you do gamma composed with alpha, it is identity. So it was the example for tracers. So first, I have this nice property. If I have a Galois connection, if you do gamma composed with alpha composed with gamma, it is exactly gamma. And you have another one which is, if I do alpha composed with gamma composed with alpha, it's exactly alpha. There is a duality principle in order theory. When you replace an order by the inverse, the dual for Galois connections is you exchange alpha and gamma. So anytime you get a theorem, you get another one by exchanging alpha and gamma. That's very nice. So here is an example where you don't have gamma. So I start from there. I do gamma. So I arrive here. And when I am here, I do alpha. I arrive here. So you see, when I do gamma composed with alpha, I arrive below. It's reductive. So it's a Galois connection, but I don't have identity. And you see the intuition, these two points, they are just different encoding on the same property. So in that case, it means that the abstract, I have several equivalent ways to say something which is a given property. I can describe it in different ways. So in mathematics, what they do, they take the quotient, they say, let us identify these two, and now I have a Galois connection which satisfies this property, and it's called a Galois embedding. But when you are a computer scientist doing an equivalent class, maybe very, very, very complicated. For example, if you represent sets by list, doing the Hilbertian class must be a normalization and so on. If you have polyhedra, if you have objects like this, doing normalization can be extremely costly. So you want to live in this case and say, I will only normalize when I really need it. For example, before doing a widening or something like that. And otherwise, I will live with the fact that I have several representations of the same object. But when you do semantics, in semantics, you never have 30 ways of expressing the same thing. Generally, there is a standard way, simplest one. So in Galois embedding, you have this condition, and so it's equivalent to alpha is surjective, or gamma is injective, or gamma composed with alpha is identity. You have another condition here, which I will skip, and I write it with this double row, and I call that a Galois embedding. So this is the ideal case. So when I said when you have a Galois connection, everything is fixed, that was not true because you have the choice between several representations. But when you have a Galois embedding, then you have only one possible encoding. Yes?
I just want to test the question on the embedding. So the idea here is that for when you have an embedding as opposed to just a connection, there's no information loss in the abstraction. Is that roughly?
No. Do you
information loss because you see in this case I have interpret that as strictly positive or positive zero negative zero positive or zero different from zero and so on. In this say I can say true, I can say negative, and I can say positive one way and positive a second way. So I can say, for example, it's plus, and here I say it's plus one. I have two different encoding of the same property. And this property is all this, that is, it's either zero or strictly positive or the disjunction of the two, and I make no distinction between these two. So I lose information in all cases, but you see here I have two encodings of the fact that it's positive. So it's usual, you can say one or plus one. And I have only one encoding of negative or zero. So here I have chosen this strictly negative. So it's, so it's the case of Sinzoff, which is problematic. But it doesn't matter. So another example of Galois connection that we have already seen is, in another form. You have a power set in the concrete, a power set of in the abstract. And what you do is you define a map F from C to A. And you define the abstraction as alpha F of P is I take all elements of F and apply the function to them. So here is an example. You see an accident on the road between two cars, and 10 years later, some policeman come and tell you, it is this car, and you say no. And the policeman say, I cannot believe you. You have not looked really at the picture. It was because you made this abstraction. Your abstraction was a car, I remember only its color. So F of a car is the color of the car. And the photo you get is not the color of the car you remember. So it cannot be the car. Example of abstraction. So another one is I can divide you in male and female. I can divide you by age classes. I can do things like that. So it's a partitioning, in fact. And so the concretization is when you give me a set of colors, I take all the cars that have these colors. And so that's a Galois connection. And if the F is surjective, you have a Galois embedding. And that the partitioning example and that the popular scheme that you see in model checking, you have traces, you map state to abstract state, you do the abstract model checking, and you hope the property is true in the concrete, which is the case if it is safety, but not if it is liveness. So another predicate abstraction that you can do is this one. You replace a function by its right, a relation by its right image. That is a function. So you take a relation between objects, between two sets here, and you replace this by the function that, given a set of states here, give me the image on the other side. So if I give you this, you answer this. And so it's a predicate. You have a transition relation here, and here you get a predicate transformer. From a set of state, I transform it into a set of state, which is the image of this set by the transition relation, and this is post. Now the inverse is pre tilde, which is not being possible to go to this state, more or less. And these pairs form a Galois connection. And this means that because reachability is post and it goes forward, there is something which is corresponding, which is going backward, which gives you exactly the same result. And so reachability, you can do it forward with post, or you can do it backward with pre tilde. And so we only have to study one because the other is a consequence of the previous one. And if you do pre, you have backward, you have... So pre is a post of the inverse, so it's the thing that can go to this. So if I have this transition here, and this is... The pre will also include this one, because I can go, but I am not sure to go. And so the adjoint is post tilde. So you have a way to transform going forward to a way going backward. That's interesting. So again, I am very late, Prof. So I will skip the properties of Galois connections, except that when you compose Galois connection, you get a Galois connection. So I have started from sign, then you see zero, strictly positive or zero, negative, and then I have said only bottom, zero, top. And I have one Galois connection here, one Galois connection here, so there is one between the first and the two. This means that when you make abstraction, you can go progressively by defining one abstraction, then another one, and compose them. That's very important in practice. Let's go, I skip all the properties. Yeah. So the next thing is when you have a Bess abstraction, that is when you take a concrete property and among the abstract property there is one which is above and the smallest one which is above, then you have got a Galois connection. And when it is not the case, you don't have a Galois connection. And this was our counterexample. When I have zero, I have two possible abstractions by saying it's positive or zero, or negative or zero. And there is not one which is smaller than the other, so there is no best abstraction. We had another example, it was polyhedra. We had no best abstraction for a disk and so on. Finite polyhedra. So if I want to solve the problem, I have to introduce zero, which was a solution by the Indian guys of 16 centuries ago. And that was not understood by Sinzoff, which is curious. Huh? Anyway, so computer scientists are smart, but there are other smart people. Huh? So I skip that. You just have to remember it's too technical. Yeah. So you remember, if there is a Bess abstraction, there is a Galois connection. If there is a Galois connection, everything is simple.
So for deciding the Bess abstraction, what parameters that are collected into the Bess abstraction, and what are the inferred aspects that of the chain among those abstractions? Can you say that?
So my
I have understood is how do you know that there is a best abstraction? No?
Which am I choosing from among to say there is a best? So what makes
best in the sense that I give you the rule of signs, I give you any set of integers, there is a sign which is common to all these. So if I give you 1, 5, you must answer positive. You could also say, I don't know. But I don't know is worse than positive. And 1, 5, there is no better than that. If I give you 0, you could say 0, you could say positive or 0, you could say I don't know, but 0 is the best. But when I say, as if you have only positive or 0, negative or 0, I give you 0, you have 2 answers that are minimal, but no one is better than the other, because we have seen in some cases I should choose one and the other, I should choose the other.
So are you saying that the abstract domain determines the abstraction?
Yes.
Having the abstraction function or the abstract domain is the same. That's in the slide that I skipped, unfortunately. But so if you have no best abstraction, here is the example. You have this, you take a polyhedra, you will find always a better one. So in that case, I have not even minimal. You see, I have infinitely many, many, many that are more and more and more precise and even not comparable, and it's a... I go to infinity before reaching the best. Another example is syntax. Syntax is a very bad way of making abstraction because there is no best abstraction. So, if for example I have ANBN is not describable by a regular expression or ANBNCN by a grammar, and so there is no regular expression to describe A and B, and that's a theorem I don't remember. So if there is none, some must fail at some rank. And so I can give you something better, because I write AB, AAB, B, A, and then I write this, your expression, and this is better than the one, because I describe one more case exactly. And I can do that at any number, but passing to the limit is no longer a regular expression, so there is no best. Same problem with all these logics, that's why I never use temporal logic and things like that. You see, I take the prime numbers here, and I want to say, this is my execution, I observe prime numbers, so if you give me any formula, it will fail. And so by the same idea, I will extend it and get a better formula. So I will improve any of your formula by just enumeration to some point. And so there is no infinite formula. If there were an infinite formula, everything would be perfect. And in some logic, you have infinite formula. For example, the NSC-Milner logic, there are infinite formula. It's because of that. Otherwise... But if you take infinite formula, it's isomorphic to set theory, so there is no advantage of inventing new notation, whereas you have the one of set theory. So we have seen two ways of coping with absence of best approximation. One is you add intersection until you get the best abstraction. What was the zero? I was adding the zero, which it was this case, you see, here, here. There was no best, so I take the intersection and I have solved the problem. But by doing so, I may introduce infinitely many intersections. And if I do that for polyhedra, I get all convex objects, which are impossible to represent efficiently in memory. So it's not the perfect solution. But when it is finite, it's always possible. When it's infinite, you see, it's difficult. If I take this one is not a good example. I should not have written that. So I have to, the second case, I have to go with life, which is hard, and consider there is no best. So this means that I will, whenever I have some property, I must choose which approximation I will choose, or do backtracking, but I exclude that. So you can just say, I make one arbitrary choice for all. This was the sins of solution. He was saying, 0 will be positive, I don't remember, maybe positive. So you use an abstraction function. You decide once for all, when I have something, I will make a choice and abstract it this way. Or you can say, I will wait, and each time I have something, I will take the decision locally, depending on what I'm doing. And in that case, it means you use a concretization function. So essentially, the results are the same, except that you have some property that you have lost, but using a concretization function will always do it. So if you have the sign, you can complete, and otherwise you use just a very simple formalization which says I have a concretization function that goes from abstract to concrete. And you assume it to be increasing. If you don't assume the concretization function to be increasing, you do not preserve implication. And so this means that if you make a proof here, then the proof will not be valid here because implication is not preserved. If you have an implication on this side, it might not be valid in the concrete. And you don't want that because you have a static analyzer. You get a result. When you concretize, it means nothing. So you don't want that. So how much time I have? You know that.
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Wow. 15? Wow. Including questions. So I will follow the advice of Danji, which is skip. But I cannot skip with computers. You cannot skip without showing that you skip. In the old days, you could push aside your slides. That's a regression. So let's you just remember that. You say, I take a concretization, a gamma, and I stop this. Reduction, I stop. Abstraction. Yes, so how another question is, because I have only a gamma, I need an order in the abstract. So how do I choose the order in the abstract? Very simple, I say, you are ordered in the abstract if you are ordered in the concrete. So the order on interval must be the concrete order. And so I concretize the interval, it's all integers in between. So I have inclusion. Then I have to do some mathematics, which is a bit trivial. I just translate the meaning of the inclusion, and I gave this formula. And so this is my definition of the order in the abstract. So when I said everything is determined with Galois connection, it means there is a best way to do it. When I have a concretization, at some time you may have choices, so you make an arbitrary choice, depending on efficiency, precision, or things like that. Now I have 10 minutes to do abstractions or fixed point, because we said we will abstract the semantic by abstracting the fixed point. To do that, we will abstract functions. I have not explained yet how I do it. And to abstract function, we will abstract their domains and codomains. So we have done only domain, codomain. So now we must go to fixed point. And the idea is, I will show the idea very simply. We have seen that you have a function, you want to you have a semantics, which is a fixed point, and you are interested in knowing the abstraction of this semantics. And what you would like is to find another abstract map so that when you take the least fixed point in the abstract, it is exactly the abstraction of the concrete. So the idea is the following. I want to know the interval of variation of my variable during execution. I have a semantics which says a reachable state. I have an abstraction which will extract the interval of value from the reachable states. And what I want is not compute the semantics and then extract the information, but compute only with interval and obtain exactly the same information. I am unfortunate, for interval it does not work. But now if you do, this is a trace semantics. This is the abstraction into OR logic. Is there a fixed point that gives me OR logic? And the answer is yes. It's not so clear where it is, but it's because logic is an inference system, and an inference system is the same as a fixed point, and so the fixed point I get is the one that describes the inference system here. So What if this is the same picture? I have the same picture two times. Yes, so that's a different picture. So I have some F here. When I take the least fixed point, I make the abstraction, I got the same. Both same picture. I don't know why. So let's keep that. And let's keep that and go there. Yes. So this is the theorem. If I have the hypothesis of the previous theorem, I will tell you what they are. I take a function in the abstract, and I have this miraculous situation. When I abstract the concrete fixed point, I exactly get the abstract fixed point using the abstract ordering and taking the image of the initial condition. So now what are the conditions on F? They are sufficient conditions. And essentially, they are this. They are F composed with alpha is alpha composed with F. They commute. That is, if I start from something, I do the concrete and abstract, it's the same as first abstracting and then doing the abstract. So this commutation condition plus something to pass to the limit, like continuity and good things like that, makes the thing work. So the interesting point is that I have this. And so I know F, I know alpha, and so by symbolic computation I can derive F. So now there is another circumstance which is even better. It is when the alpha is a Galois connection, then the F has only one possibility, which is alpha composed with F composed with gamma. So it means the specification of the abstract transformer is start from the abstract argument, go in the concrete, apply the concrete function, and abstract the result. And this is the only way that you can have this commutation condition. And so I know how exactly I should define F. So I was saying there is only one choice. It's a Galois embedding, so I have only one choice of representation of F, even. And with that unique F, it is the one where I will have equality. So where does it work? It works, for example, to get a parser from a grammar. And what is the abstraction is you forget all sentence but the input sentence. It's like it's the same abstraction of this one. You forget all functions but the buttons. Here, the other was you forget all sentences but the input. And you make this abstraction, you take the fixed point semantic of grammars, and you get a parser. If you have a semantics, you have trace semantics, you abstract initial final state, you get a predicate transformer semantics, and there is a unique way of defining predicate transformers. So the second case is when you are not lucky. When you are not lucky, you have no best abstraction, and it was the case in intervals. When you have the situation, you have the least fixed point, you would like to compute the intervals, but the only way, the only F will work, will give you something larger. And that's the case when you have to solve an undecidable problem by a computer. You always have this problem. So in that case, I think it's good because it's not bad, but it's not best because best would be to find exactly. So the best exists mathematically, but usually it's not computable, and so you say the one that is given by math is not useful. I will find some other one. So then there is three cases. If you want to prove something greater than the abstraction of the least fixed point and your thing is less, then you are happy. You say yes. Now when you want to prove something greater than F and it's smaller than the alpha and this one, when it's smaller than this one, there are two cases. Either it's smaller than alpha or it's greater than alpha. But you don't know that. So you don't know where are because you don't know the semantics, you know the alpha, but not alpha of the semantics, so you don't know if the point is on the left or the right. So you don't know if it's an error or it's a false alarm. That's the abstraction is not good. And that's inherent to any approximation. So I will skip that. And essentially, so I will give you the last theorem that is important, which is this one. Yes. So you see here, you no longer have an equality. You have an inequality. And in the commutation condition, you no longer have equality, but you have an over approximation. And the nice thing is that you can do either with alpha or with gamma, it works the same. And so in that case, you will say, I have several choices because I don't have equality. I will take any one and hopefully it will work. So I'm done now. What did I have? I had widening, narrowing. I can just give you one idea. You don't see this. So essentially, this is I start from bottom, I compute f of bottom, then I compute the next, and I compute the next, and you see I converge slowly, and it takes infinitely many steps. So the idea of what we had was we will compute and then extrapolate, compute and then extrapolate, compute and extrapolate, and one idea for doing widening is to do thresholds. If you do threshold and you put infinitely many up to the thing, it will ensure convergence and loss of information. So I have defined what is a widening. It's an over approximation of its argument, and it enforces termination. If you take a sequence and you make widening with this sequence, it must converge. And essentially, it says it's correct. Then I will just keep all this and say, how do I do a widening for polyhedra? So I have a polyhedron, I have another polyhedron, and polyhedra are represented by constraint, that is hyperplane less than this hyperplane. So I have, I say the widening will be S1 union S2. So let's think of S1. S1 is the constraint that are stable. You see, it was in P1, and it is still true in P2. It means that I made an iteration and the constraint remain valid. So I keep it. And then this one is a bit more subtle. I take also the constraints of P2 that are not stable, but could have replaced some constraint in P1 that would be stable. So I will give you an example, it's simpler. So here is I do the widening, I have x equal y, then x equal y or x plus y, it's y minus 1 equal x. And you see the iteration, this constraint is not stable. This one is stable, this one is not. It's larger than this one it is, but on this direction, it's not stable. So I just drop the things that are not stable and I get this widening. So another one is this one, this line, second iteration. I say, look, this thing is not stable, it was there, now it's there, so I drop it. Now the second case is this one. I have P, I have Q. So you see this one was not there here. This one, it was not there in the previous one. So if I just say I just drop all the constraints that are not stable, then I will drop this one by my criteria. And to avoid that, I say, yes, but look, this one is a constraint of P2 that I could have placed here and it would have changed nothing. So in fact, it was an implicit constraint here that did not, I did not put because it was useless, it was redundant, but if I had put it, it would be okay. So because of that, I will keep it. And this one, I drop it. Because it was there and it was not stable. So narrowing we skip. And conclusion, abstraction is great. Does scale up, great research subject. Applies to many things, even more things. It has great successes now in computational biology. I'm always interested in the last thing I have done, so I did that last month on B-simulation. So all the stuff on B-simulation is trivial abstraction. It took me 10 years to understand why. And to answer a question of Danvi, in this paper here, and this one is the following of this one. This is a question of a guy in the assistance who told me, this was for transition system. He said, if you do with functional languages, it will not work. So I did not understand the question because my English is not perfect. So to have a second chance, I told him, you say, I make great effort to speak English. Maybe you, when you ask questions, you should make effort to speak with a French accent. And this poor guy repeated his question, very nice guy, with a French accent. And all the audience was laughing completely as his French accent. So I said, no, you see, it works. No difficulty. I will make it work. And then it took me 10 years to... So I followed Darby's example. I thought every morning, I should do it for... And someday I started, and in 10 years it succeeded, so... Never. And in biology now it's working well because you have best abstraction and complete, that is equality between fixed points. So you have abstraction that makes lose no information. It means you study the physical system, you forget about good things, and your study is simpler and remain valid. That's it. And challenges. Challenges, you see this system is some plane. It has many screens here that offer to the pilots information about all the plane. The program that does that is 3 million lines. It's a parallel program. It's 15 processors. The question is, how do you prove absence of runtime errors? So that's our present challenge. I think in 2 or 3 years we will make it. Bibliography, too much papers that no one read. So thank you. I'm late, as usual.
I've been curious about a piece of history with this forever. I wonder if you could just say a little bit about sort of when you started with this. Back in the early mid 70s, what were the questions that you were looking at? I mean, at the time, we had Scott Scrici semantics and their use of lattices there, and we had some use of lattice theoretic work in data flow analysis. And
yes, so that I can tell you the story.
So we did the work. At the time, we had no internet, nothing like that. So we did not knew anything about data flow analysis. Completely ignorant about that. So we did our work. We did not knew about Scott either, things like that. So we discovered fixed points and things like that, and widenings and all this stuff. And then we had a contract, and then some guy who was Leroux, maybe Danvi, you know him, Bernard Leroux, he worked on attribute grammars, he came and he had a thesis of Kildall. So we read that and we said, well, we have to change the subject. Everything has been done before. let's stop. We were completely discouraged. And Loro told us, no, you should not be discouraged because they have no proof of correctness. And then we said, yes, but they have no infinite lattices. So we submitted, and there was a very interesting guy at the time visiting Grenoble. It was Steve Warshall, which is Warsh Boolean Theorem on Matrices. He arrived in my office, and he said, "I am Warshall." I said, "The theorem." He said, "Yes." He said, "What are you doing?" I explained him. He said, "Very interesting, submit to Popple." So we submitted to Popple, and we were extremely lucky because, so we submitted 90 pages, handwritten. thick like this, you had to make copies, so we sent the copy, and we had an old car, and when going to the post office last day for sending, the car drops because of a storm. So so we do like this, and we arrive at the post office, we submit just in time. And the chairman was Ravi Sethi, and he decided to eliminate all references to any other work. So he took white, and he with white he put white on all references, and then he dropped the references, he dropped the first page, and then he sent it to refereeing. And now, 30 years later, I know who had an influence among the referees. It was Zohar Mana, who was interested in this widening because at the time he was working on optimal fixed points, at fixed points that are not least. And so because we had this do widening and come back, he saw there is something here. The unfortunate point is that we had to reduce to 15 pages. So the whole part on traces, semantics, which was not very, it was good, but not as elaborated it is now, had to be dropped. So we started with this flowchart in the middle, and the thing before were not there. So it's my regret. Then we had, so Radia was working on linear programming before, so she knew well about simplex programming and things like that. So we had this idea with Alvax of polyhedra, and that was a real start because this was doing very complex things that were not possible with other previous techniques. That is, none of data flow analysis, none. So now in my course I explain data flow analysis, but with a semantic point of view. And what is interesting, for example, you get the fact that you have a program graph as part of the abstraction. That is, you define the abstraction and you see that there is a program graph that come in. Then you see that you make abstractions. When you make abstraction explicit, for example, you see things like data flow analysis is optimal with respect to the program graph. You cannot improve the equation, but it is not with respect to the semantics of the program. So you can always improve data flow analysis by going to a level which is not considered in the theory of data flow analysis. Another example is when you do model shaking, you can combine things like the states that are reachable and can reach some other state. So the states that are reachable from entry state and reach potentially, so it's a post-star of the initial state and pre of the final state. When you do this, you make the intersection of two fixed points. Now, if you do abstract interpretation, you have to reason with respect to concrete. And when you develop the algorithm, you see that it's not optimal. And so you have optimal algorithms that are more complex, and that live in between the abstract but with respect to the concrete, and they are not expressible only in the abstract. So I think the interest of having these two things, concrete and abstract and method, to go from one to the other is not only theoretical, it also gives practical things, practical ideas. So the whole difficulty is the widening. It's extremely difficult to communicate on that because we have no design method. We have See, for the least fixed point, I can tell you, see, if you have a Galois connection, here is the best you can do. So you have some reference to which you can refer to program and know if what you do is good or bad or best or not. But for widening, we have nothing. We just say, here is a definition, and here are infinitely many examples, and then next one you have to guess. And this is not studied because the community is small. So progress is much slower than in other disciplines because there are not many people. Also, another problem is that the scope is large. So you have many people, but they are in completely different subjects. So it's a bit difficult to have these people progress together. But I hope you will be all doing abstract interpretation after this course. And so we will at least double the community. Maybe there are 200 people that know, which should be compared to, 4,000 for model checking, 30,000 for object-oriented languages. So that's so a social question. No other question? So I thank you once again.